Inspiring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Listening in is Philip Starr of Selma, California, a ball turret gunner in B-24s and B-17s during World War II, shares stories, some of which his family members haven't even heard before, with Fresno Christian High School students who just finished studying World War II. These teenagers come up with some pretty thought-provoking questions, like this one.
So what is your attitude, or what is your thoughts on the difference in attitude towards young men, their thoughts of war today, versus young men during World War II and their thoughts of war?
You could have stayed it back there.
Tough
no,
question.
No, I don't know. Most of us prepared in a way for what we were doing at home. I was in high school. I was better than average, knock on wood, in sports. I played football. I did some track. I played basketball. And I was very good in baseball. So I had that worry, then I had a blonde-headed girl that I was worried about. So all these things fit in there. In other words, I don't think it's any different with you. You have your things that you do that would take you away from it. But my last few days before I went into the service, well, for instance, your teacher's a history teacher, and I was flunking history. But I couldn't see any sense in history. I wanted to see it. I wanted to touch something. But anyway,
you were about to live history. You didn't feel like
I started. I started learning history the hard way.
Good
but
question.
As far as your question, I don't know how you kids feel about it. I mean, to know what your mind thought is compared to mine, one thing. I wrote a lot of letters. The first thing that happened with your letters, they went into headquarters at your squadron, and one or two or more, three or four officers sat and did nothing but read my mail and the other people's mail to see what we were telling. For instance, some way I told the folks that I would let them know how many missions I had by saying, I sure wished I could get some more chewing gum. Well, one of the officers said, well, if this kid needs chewing gum, I'll go buy him some. And the other officer said, well, he's telling his folks that he's been on 15 missions.
Is that because chewing gum costs 15 cents or something?
No.
What was the code there?
Well, yeah, I would say, I don't know what I said.
But you had given your folks basically a key to decode your letters.
But you kids are in a position where I don't understand at all. You go overseas or you go to a base, and you got your telephones, and you're able to talk. How they kept secrets, I don't know. How you would.
These days, as interconnected as we are, a little harder, sure. Did everybody see that medal that Mrs. Friesen has there? So that's the Distinguished Flying Cross. Some guys claim they hand those out like candy, but I know that's not true. There's a reason they say it's distinguished. You have to do something to distinguish yourself. Do you know why they gave you that medal?
The day that these medals were handed out, we probably got orders from the squadron to put your Class A uniforms on and fall out. There'd be medals presented. I got the Air Medal that way. The Distinguished Flying Cross, I don't remember when I got it, but I'm sure that I got it for a mission that we flew to Bremen. In other words, we hit an oil refinery. Now, the reason that we wanted to hit oil refineries, for instance, the more we could knock out their oil, the less we had to worry about their airplanes and their tanks and what have you. Because the reason we were doing all this is put Germany back into their homeland, put Hitler out of operation.
So that mission, you guys take out this oil refinery, so you're limiting their mobility, their ability to advance on the ground if they don't have oil to fuel all these vehicles. So that's why they gave you the DFC, was the strategic importance?
We hit the oil refinery absolutely perfect. We blew it completely off the map. I was sitting in the ball turret, and I saw the smoke come up, and it was a big column of smoke. So I knew we had zeroed in. We got the DFC, and I already had the Air Medal, and our outfit got the President's Unit Citation. But we didn't flaunt many of our medals.
Are you guys waiting to ask questions?
Go.
You go home and open up about your experiences.
No. You kids are getting to hear more than probably my kids hearing. My son's hearing things that he hadn't heard before. I don't know really why. You just didn't. That's it. My kids don't know a lot of things that I know that I've forgotten or don't want them to know.
Was it just too hard to think about?
Yeah. I could tell you other stories, but I'm not going to.
I think a lot of people want to hear some other stories in here. I don't know. I mean, I'm just speaking
for
myself.
I'll tell you one. You're going to think I'm nasty, but that's all right. On an airplane, you're at, we'll say, 25,000 feet. The temperature is 30 below zero.
Did you guys all hear that? 30 below zero.
So all of a sudden, you have to go number one in the bathroom. You've got a little tube about this big around. So you stay away from any place you touch, you're going to freeze to it. Okay, you do your job. The next guy gets up, and he goes up to do it, and all of a sudden it all runs out on his feet because the tubes all froze.
Hazards of war. There you go. Hey, let me ask you a question before we get some more from these young people here. But did you have a clear idea of why you were over there, of what you were hoping to accomplish, and did you feel some sense of purpose in what you were doing?
Well, yeah, but not to the point where I'm standing up and jumping up and down about it, no. We knew we had a job to do. The quicker you got it through, the better. I came home. Some of the crews flew home. I came home on a French liner called the Île de France. We landed in Boston, and there was snow on the ground. The Salvation Army was there with donuts and coffee for us. I was on the train between Boston and California on Christmas 1944.
What do you remember about the German soldiers, and have you ever confronted one of them?
I don't remember anything about a German soldier because I never saw one. I never set foot on any foreign soil except England. I flew out of England. We went over to all these different countries, but we didn't do any landing, and that's for sure.
How hard was it for you to adjust from being in a peaceful situation to a wartime situation and then back after you were done in service?
The beginning is easy. You start out and you grow as you go. But after coming back, after doing 35 missions and seeing what little I saw, there was nothing at home that I needed.
There's a real obvious question that I haven't asked, and I'm wondering if some of you guys have thought of it. If he flew half of his missions in a B-24 and half in a B-17, they're both bombers, but they're completely different designs. They have different capabilities. Any of you guys wondering which one he liked better?
Okay, the B-24 was hydraulically operated. If any of you know anything about cars and what have you, hydraulics operates quick. For instance, one day, the pilot evidently wanted to put the plane in automatic pilot, and he could hide his head and let the plane fly through the clouds. Unbeknown to us, we had a ground crew engineer on there, and the aileron automatic pilot was acting up. So to check it, somebody hit the thing, and we went straight up, hanging on four props before they broke it loose. I was tacked to the floor. In other words, I'm saying that hydraulics is very severe. The B-17 was all electric. The B-17 had a bigger wingspan. It would operate better at high altitude. The B-24 operated better at low altitude. The B-24 had a Davis wing, which had all the lift, but it didn't have the air surface to control it that the B-17 had. These are all my ideas. I'm not a pilot. I've never flown an airplane and don't plan on it.
So was it more comfortable for you in the B-17?
Oh, not really. I think we was at 50 below zero in the B-17, and I froze my earlobe to the headset.
If it's 50 below zero because there's no pressurization, how do you keep from freezing in that ball turret?
Well, I wore a full uniform under my electric uniform. See, I was lucky enough to get over there after they had improved a lot of things. The crews that went early in the war wore fur lines, top and bottom, fur-lined boots, fur-lined jacket, pants, headgears. We had, it looked like a dress suit, and it was all electric. We had electric gloves, we had electric in our boots and in our body. I'm not saying that they were perfect. I'm not saying that we weren't cold. And if you lost your electricity in your suit, you were going to get very cold.
And how long did most of your missions take?
We got up between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. We went to eat breakfast. We were briefed on everything that we were going to do, to tell us where we're going, how high, and everything. We'd go on the flight line. We'd go on a mission. Maybe it was 5, 6. If we went to Berlin, it was a long flight. We would come back, and the first thing we would do when we got back, they took us into briefing. Well, I hope you kids don't know what I'm talking about next. We had hot coffee and a double shot of rye whiskey. There's one thing about it. After about 8 hours or more in the air with nothing to eat, you could talk real easy. The funny part of it, we took apples and oranges with us one day. We was going to eat them at altitude. They froze so solid we threw them out and hoped to hit a German.
I haven't heard that one before. I like that. You know, I think there's another important question that I just realized I asked these young folks, but I didn't ask you. I asked if there are any volunteers for people who'd like to go fly in a ball turret. Was that a position you volunteered for, or did they tell you that was your job?
I volunteered for it.
What in the world were you thinking?
In fact, if you talk to people, they're going to tell you you were tall, too tall, and too big for the ball turret. Well, it was cozy, but I liked it because I stood 5'11", and I weighed all of them, probably the most 150, maybe.
I don't want you to hold back on anything. I mean, if there's something, here's the time to get it off your chest. But with everything you went through, the 35 missions, the close calls, the days that it could have been you, the days that it was the plane right next to you, with everything that you went through, what would you say that you're most proud of?
Being able to do it and come home.
Were there days where you weren't sure you were going to come home?
Naturally, any day you went, you didn't know whether you're coming home. I mean, there's no guarantees you're going to get off the ground to start with. I never was in a real crash landing, but we had weather-related going over. We had a different pilot. He came in too high. A V-24, if you came in, you had to come in hot and drop right on the runway. He came in too high with, he had practically a full gas load and a full bomb load and hit the ground too hard and blew the landing gear, and we wound up out across the field in the dirt. So I did survive one crash landing. And as crazy as it sounds, I was the armament engineer on the plane. So the first thing I did when the plane stopped was go into the bomb bay and see if the bombs were all right. Crazy. If they wasn't all right, we'd have already blown up.
Yeah. And if they were about to blow up, you're walking into the wrong spot.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
When you came back, were you able to take part in any coming home celebrations?
Not really. No. I came home to my family and my friends, some of them. The one that I was going to go in with, he wound up in the Navy and got mumps, and they went down on him, so I didn't have him to put up with. The two young ladies that I was with, while I was overseas, I got a Dear John letter, and she had gotten married, so I had to start all over. But no, I didn't feel like I was left out. This jacket I'm wearing, it says Honor Flight.
Central Valley Honor Flight, you bet.
I was lucky enough to be able to go on it. It's the most amazing flight that I've ever been on. My son went with me. He was my guard. He wasn't supposed to get an arm's length away from me all the time we were gone, and he took very good care of me. But this is the only party that, as far as I'm concerned, that I went on.
Well, and what was that party like when you came back to the airport in Fresno and saw all those people waving their flags and cheering for you?
Well, you get off the plane, and we walked through. There must have been 40 sailors saluting us as we came in. And then we got into the other area, and people were screaming and carrying on, and my family was there, and it was just an outstanding thing. But the main thing about the Honor Flight is, you kids don't understand it, and maybe someday you'll get to go on one of these things, but this was the most amazing bunch of men and women to take us on this flight and have everything so perfect. There's not a word I could say wrong about it. I was on a wheelchair because, as you see, I'm sitting on this. They had buses where the wheelchair was brought up into the bus. My son was out, took care of me. The buses driving on the wrong side of the roads, driving through stop signs to get us there.
With police escort?
It was crazy, yeah. With police escort.
And the whole idea behind the Honor Flight is to get guys like you to the World War II Memorial. which wasn't built until 60 years after the war, because guys like you donated to make it happen, $190 million of private money. And it's there to honor more than 400,000 Americans who died in the war. And you know how close you came to being one of those. What was that like for you to be at that memorial and take it all in?
It's really quite a thing. It's difficult to say, talk about these things. The people that got to go on it, it's great that they got to go. And it was great that my son and I got to go, because he got to push me all over Washington.
And you mentioned your son. How many children and grandchildren do you have?
Oh, I have three children. I have two boys and a girl. Why didn't you tell me ahead of time on the rest of it?
Doing the math?
Yeah.
You have quite a few grandkids, too?
I think there's six grandkids and six or eight great-grandkids.
Uh-huh. Well, we don't have to do all the math, although I know these high school students can handle it. But
let them figure it out then.
Yeah, we won't do it for them. But here's my point. Isn't that a lot of people who wouldn't be here, who would have never been born if you didn't survive 35 missions?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of truth in that, more than poetry.
Well, before we wrap this up, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for being here today and telling us about it. And are there any more of those stories that you've never told before that you want to share before we turn this off?
No, I think probably we better leave it alone. I just want to thank you all for letting me be here. I hope I didn't bore you too much. I told your teacher that I feel kind of at home being here because I was custodian at Selma Unified School District for 17 years. So I know a lot of you kids' pranks. Oh.
Well, I have a feeling that they're grateful that you were here to share some stories today and that they're grateful for your service to our country. The applause went on and on, but that's more than just a courtesy clap. These teenagers were really moved by Mr. Starr's story. We're going to hear briefly now from two Fresno Christian High School students. First, freshman Blake Deffenbacher, then junior Tyler Valines.
Through the stories that he shared, I saw a lot of the bravery and courage that he had in what he did, and that was really inspiring, because from a guy like him, who's been through all the stuff he's been through, it's just amazing that someone could do that and still be around today to share about it.
Did it have any effect on how you view America or the freedom that we have?
Yeah, well, like you hear over and over again, freedom isn't free. And I just saw that as another example of that, because all the things that he went through, all the things that all the soldiers went through back then, it wasn't easy. It was a lot of work. But overall, they fought for our freedom, and that's how we got it.
The thing that stuck with me the most and struck me the most was how humble he was. Whenever we'd be like, he's a hero. But like, his mindset was, well, I came back. The real heroes were the ones that passed away during the war. And whenever we'd point out, like, wow, these medals are amazing, it meant nothing to him, because he had a firsthand experience and he realized the struggles and the pains that happened throughout the war. And he was just so humble about it, when so easily he could be taking a bunch of credit. My favorite thing about hearing veteran stories was being able to try to put myself in their shoes. The biggest thing for me is how terrifying it would be, and the amount of uncertainty that comes with being in one of those planes. All it takes is a bullet in the right spot and the plane goes down, or you jump and you get caught behind enemy lines. It's just unbelievable. And being able to see truly how God worked in his life during the war and how he was inches from death, it just blows me away, and it's so fun to be able to put myself in that position and kind of take on the situation in my mind.
Was there one little anecdote or story that he told that maybe wowed you the most or really made an impression on you?
Yeah, when he was talking about how he still has that piece that struck right next to his head, and he took it home and kept it from, like, the bombs going off outside. I just thought that was phenomenal, just because of the sheer fact that he was inches from death and he still holds that near and dear to his heart. It's just amazing to see how close he came to not being with us anymore. And now he's back from the war after we'd won, telling a bunch of high schoolers about the adventures and the hardships that came with being in the war. That specifically right there struck me, and it's going to stick with me for a long time.
And finally, a quick word from Terry Starr, Phil's son, his guardian on the honor flight, and himself a veteran of Vietnam and Desert Storm. Terry is thankful for his dad's powerful example.
He was a living, breathing example of patriotism. I can remember going with him to the Veterans Hospital and dealing with the poppies. I got to know people and got to learn to respect those veterans. Didn't really know what all they did. but I knew what they stood for. He was and is a great role model.
And this weekend, he turns 93. Happy birthday, Mr. Starr. You can hear more of Terry Starr's thoughts about his dad, as well as a couple more questions from the students, if you pull up the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Find photos there and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And before I sign off today, a big thank you to M-Cubed Technologies, because this episode wouldn't have aired without them. All the audio you heard today had to be rescued from a failing hard drive on my laptop, but M-Cubed was up to that challenge. So if you ever find yourself in that kind of scenario, look them up at mcubedtechnologies.com. I think a high schooler already beat me to the punch, but as I sign off from another episode of Hometown Heroes, let me remind you once again, as Mr. Starr's story helped us understand anew today, that freedom is not free.